everyone. Good afternoon. Hope everybody stays cool. Either my bottle grew or this podium is shrinking, one or the other. It's good to see Mark and Larissa Bosserman. Great to have you with us here. And also we have other guests here in our midst. The Schmidt family, so I see the Allwines. Welcome. It's good that you could do the trip here. And given your smile, you know, you do a little bit better, Mrs. Allwine. Good. Anybody else too? I know we have a few. Who is here for camp? For a pre-teen camp? You know, just, and who plans on going? Who's the last commit? You know, yeah, right. Now you have to talk to Mr. Schreiber then, if you want to be a last commit. But, we're excited. Tomorrow, camp will start. And all of us involved hope that it's going to be the best camp ever. It's precious to be able to, you know, to do, serve our young ones. We even have a mini dorm, you know, for those, siblings who have not reached, I think, the age of six or so. But it's always precious to see, especially the little ones, because they look up to the other preteens. And to see the preteens look up to all the teens. You know, the pressure is on you, teens. Yeah. Now it's great. Also, welcome to everyone who is able to join us via webcast. I don't know if you have somebody with phone hookup anymore at this stage, but welcome. I'm glad you could join us today. And what a wonderful blessing that we can assemble here in peace and harmony, especially as we hear the news just this past week. I don't need to go into the details, but this, you know, how precious is that to us, that we can come together as the people of God, as the family of God, in peace. And I hope we never take this privilege for granted, and I will go into this in the sermon. Only our Father knows how much longer we can continue gather together in peace and quiet as the social mood around us can change with little advance notice. Now, as we see the news, it seems there's a certain level of anger out there and people are ready to snap. Who is familiar with the news outlet Arutz Sheva? The following news flash is from Arutz Sheva, which caught my attention. The Vatican wants to lay its hands on Jerusalem. Again, the title of that news flash is "The Vatican wants to lay its hands on Jerusalem." Peace negotiations, it's quote, here's the article, "Peace negotiations in the Middle East must tackle the issue of the status of the holy sites of Jerusalem," Cardinal Jean-Louis Thorin, head of the Vatican's Council for Interreligious Dialogue, declared several days ago in Rome. The Vatican's former foreign minister asked to place some Israeli holy places under Vatican authority, alluding to the cenacle on Mount Zion and the Garden of Gethsemane at the foot of the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. The first site also houses what is referred to as the King David's tomb. There will not be peace if the question of the holy sites is not adequately resolved. Thorin said, the part of Jerusalem within the walls with the holy sites of the three religions is humanity's heritage. The sacred and unique character of the area must be safeguarded, and it can only be done with a special internationally guaranteed statute. The Israeli government and the Vatican are deadlocked in discussions over the status of the religious sites. Vatican officials are now reiterating their demand for control over the religious sites in the ancient and holy city founded by King David as the capital of ancient Israel and now the capital of the reestablished Jewish state. Dani Ayalon, Israel's deputy foreign minister, declared that Israel might consider giving the Vatican a greater role, so I quote, in operating the sites, maybe to accommodate some of that pressure. As noble as this initiative appears, history as well as prophecy warn us of what unfolded over 2 millennia ago, as well as of how events will unfold in the not too distant future. And as we see in world's events, and also how quickly, to a degree, 9/11 was brought onto us, depending whom you ask, but I would say as at least for 99% of humanity or humans, the events of 9/11 came rather instantly, and who knows now how quickly events can turn in that part of the world. As we understand, Syria is at the brink of collapse, or at least the Assad regime, due to foreign intervention, and just overall the zeitgeist, which started with the Arab Spring a couple of years ago. The specific purpose question of this message is, what relevance does prophecy in general, and the latter part of Daniel 11 in particular, have for us today? What relevance does prophecy in general and the latter part of Daniel 11 in particular have for us today? Now, there's so much history and so much meaning in the book of Daniel and the chapter 11 by itself. Blow up the scope of this message, what I could easily fit into 1 hour. It's really the second part, the latter part of Daniel 11 that we will look at. Let's explore and reflect on this question in the remaining minutes of this message. For those of you who like, or of us who like a title, it's Reflections on Daniel 11. Reflections on Daniel 11. The first point I would like to touch on is our Father is in absolute control. You know, just right from the get-go, I think we have to focus what is an indisputable fact. And as we see, as we look at this prophecy and when it was foretold, and then the first fulfillment, and in the future possible second fulfillment, you know, we see, you know, how our Father is in absolute control. Our Father is in absolute control. Are we convinced that our Father is in control and that world events happen according to His plan and purpose? I hope nobody is in here that somehow believes that there's this gigantic battle between good and evil, and who knows who's going to win out, because oftentimes the media and movies and everything else, every novel wants to give us that impression to us, there's this gigantic battle between good and evil, and who knows how it's going to turn out. Sometimes it appears, if you look at world events, obviously evil will triumph. But as we fully understand and hopefully come to see throughout this message, our Father is in absolute control every minute of the day. And He doesn't let anything happen if He doesn't choose to do so. Please take your Bibles and join with me to Daniel, the book of Daniel, and chapter 11. The book of Daniel, part of the apocalyptic literature of the Bible, the true God of Israel inspired Daniel to record the longest continuous prophecy in the Bible. And again, it is so extensive that it would just transcend just one sermon. Chapter 11, just as an overview, depicts a prophecy of successive empires, kingdoms, namely Greece, Egypt, Syria, and finally Rome. Starting with Greece, Egypt, Syria, and finally Rome. Daniel 11 verse 1. Also I, in the first year of Darius of the Medes, even I stood to encourage and to strengthen him. The prophecy was given in the year 538 before Christ, centuries before its first and millennia before its final fulfillment. Like many prophecies, this one is likely dual in some ways. Events that have occurred in ancient times could be replicated at the time of the end. And to a large extent, what we believe, it will be replicated. And for purposes of our study today, let's just focus on the latter part of chapter 11. The entire chapter provides such a detail of account of key world events that were to unfold that biblical students and scholars alike stand in awe of its precise prediction and subsequent fulfillment. Now, there are some, but fortunately they're only in a minority, that would say, hey, no, that was a good trick. You know, whoever recorded this must have been after, you know, the events of Antiochus Epiphanes and so forth. There's no way. But no, we know better. And fortunately, the wide majority of scholars would agree with us that it was given, this prophecy was given 538 years, before Christ, and which is actually centuries before its first fulfillment. In this context, it is imperative to note that our Father does not only exercise absolute control over world affairs, but fortunately for us, as the blessed children of His, He's very much interested in each one of us. Now, that's a very important thing to see about prophecy. Depending whom you study and from whom you read certain things, it seems like there's this just a kind of macro view of events. No, our Father is very much interested how each one of us, His very children, are doing. And that includes our teens, our little ones. Do we find comfort and do we appreciate His protection and guidance on each one of us in particular and the body of Christ in general? And we'll go a little bit more obviously through that. The second point that I would like to touch on is our all-consuming ambition. What is our all-consuming ambition? To build or to tear down? To build or to tear down? Verse 17, to fast forward here, Daniel 11, verse 17. Again, he shall set his face to enter with the power of his whole kingdom and his confederates with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. And I think it's very important to start at this point. And Antiochus III, whom this is written about, went as far as to give his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to Ptolemy Epiphanes. And again, we're going to go through quite a few names, but let's not get hung up on names, but just various players here in the fulfillment of this prophecy. Ruler over Egypt in order to gain influence over the wealthy Nile Delta. And I thought, like, how smart is that? You know, you give your own daughter and to gain influence. But in this case, you know, it backfired on him because the daughter, you know, loving her husband, sided with her husband. But instead of helping her father, Cleopatra assisted her husband against her father. This deal, having had the appearance of uprightness, eventually failed, obviously, for Antiochus III in this case. Many an allegiance appears upright on the surface, but bear in itself the seed of destruction. We see that over and over, whether or not it is in world, empires, whether or not it's within church organizations. We see that over and over. Unless our Father blesses an alliance, it will eventually crumble and succumb. As smart and crafty as we humans believe we are, all such efforts are pure foolishness to Him. And of course, we don't even have to look too far in world events, you know, and who is an ally for a short period of time, you know, 10 years later, all bets are off, it seems, you know, and people start fighting each other. And we see a lot of that, you know, where the U.S. has given weaponry to so-called allies. And before we know it, before a decade is out, you know, we end up fighting against those individuals using those weapons against us. Having grown up in an environment filled with insatiable hunger for world dominance, Antiochus IV witnessed the rise as well as the fall of his father. And again, we see that quite a bit, where events can accelerate pretty quickly, and once a close ally, no more, just a few years or a few decades later. Verse 18, after this shall he return his face unto the isles and shall take many, but the prince shall cause his shame to light upon him, besides that he shall cause his own shame to turn upon himself. Antiochus III stirred up strife as long as he lived, and eventually, like with anybody that has set his sight too high, gambled too high, and was defeated in Greece and Asia Minor by a superior Roman force. In the peace treaty of Apamea in 188 BC, Roman general Popilio Scipio set a high cost on Antiochus III for peace. And I only cover this piece to dissection to establish that groundwork as to not to understand more the drive and soul of this individual son, Antiochus Epiphanes. A scholar wrote in the New Encyclopedia Britannica, the 1991 edition, he, Antiochus III, renounced all claims to his conquests in Europe and in Asia Minor west of the Taurus, and also was obliged to pay an indemnity of 15,000 talents over a period of 12 years, surrender his elephants and his fleet, and furnish hostages, including his son, Antiochus IV. And that's going to be very key to see what drives Antiochus and so forth as he goes across the entire Middle East and tries to find, the treasures which happen to be housed in temples of the time. And that's very important to understand, what that drive was. The all-consuming ambition of Antiochus III had finally brought defeat to his kingdom, the kingdom of the north. How about us? What is our all-consuming ambition? In whatever we do, whether or not it's in school for the children, whether or not it's at work, whether or not it is within the church, is our ambition to build the house of our Father, the church. However, whoever attempts the flip side of that too, whoever attempts to tear down the house will themselves be defeated. And again, we see that across organizations, within organization, throughout the Church of God at any given time. The laws of cause and effect are in play here. Verse 19, for he shall turn his face toward the forts of his own land, but he shall be overthrown and fall and be no more found. Boraike, in his work entitled The New Testament Era, The World of the Bible from 500 BC to AD 100, wrote that this tremendous war debt led the humiliated Antiochus III, quote, to retain his financial position by confiscating temples, which were the central banks of that period, but he was slain at Elymais during one of these episodes. As you can about imagine, it's not going to fly well with folks when people, grab that which was given to the gods, or even, as we will see, to the one true God of Israel. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his place in the glory of the kingdom one that shall raise taxes, but after a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in wrath nor in battle. Antiochus III, leaving a huge war debt, was succeeded by his son, Seleucus IV Philopater, who reigned the house of Seleucus for 12 years. Due to the heavy tax burden imposed by Rome, he was forced to seek an ambitious taxation policy on his shrunken empire. This included heavy taxation on the people of Israel. At times, taxes might be raised, as we understand. Various user fees levied, a host of tariffs put in effect, the currency devalued today, or folks are hit up for donations to various causes and efforts. In all of these cases, the hardworking people are left holding the proverbial back, and nothing has changed to this day. In fact, Seleucus IV even sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to the temple in Jerusalem to extract money. In the meantime, the Roman Senate decided to trade hostages. It's what they would do, you know. They get one heir to the throne, and they say, he's probably, now we have converted him. No, he's not with us. Now we swap him out against maybe his brother, and then indoctrinate him. They order Seleucus IV to send his son Demetrius, the heir to the throne, to Rome. In return, the Romans released Seleucus IV, younger brother, and Tychus IV. But as we will see, as this will unfold, and Tychus IV, even though he was very much impressed by what the Romans can do and by their might, and truly had a respect for them, you know, a fear more than a respect, in a sense, you know, he obviously found his way around to the detriment of God's people at that time. Verse 21, "And in his place shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." And here we learn something very powerful about this individual. "He shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries," in verse 21. With Seleucus IV dead, the rightful heir to the throne was the young Demetrius. However, he was no longer available, having been sent to Rome to be a hostage. And then the opportunist that Antiochus was, you know, after he heard of his brother's death, he quickly sailed to Pergamum, and flattering an individual there, you know, to help him actually go and get closer, or help with the overthrow of the heir who took over at that point. He actually, the individual who took over the reign was a 5-year-old. Also called Antiochus, but of course, then the senior Antiochus, you know, will come in, became known as Epiphanes, and became so-called his protector. Verse 22, "And the arm shall be overthrown with a flood before him, and shall be broken, and also the prince of the covenant." Because of his ability to charm and influence people and to ally himself with them, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes was able to overcome all threats to the throne. You know, he possessed so-called political agility. And ultimately, or actually his brother, or actually a nephew, was on the throne at that time, the 5-year-old. But actually so happened that on one occasion he left town, and of course something happened to that child, and he will come back as quickly to be the rescuer of that kingdom, and then as such installed himself as the true ruler. Verse 23, "And after a league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and overcome with a small people." It's interesting, the dynamics in Egypt, as his aunt, in essence, is married to the king in Egypt, but being loyal to them, you know, trying to get his foot there in the door, obviously was not as easy. But his mother Cleopatra, was Antiochus the IV's sister, actually, in this case. And Antiochus IV sought an allegiance or an alliance with Ptolemy the VI, seeking to take advantage of what he perceived as weakening to the Ptolemaic kingdom and gain Egypt for himself. You know, he moved through Syria and Judea into Egypt with a small army so as not to arouse suspicion of his true motive and seized Egypt. As we see here, is an individual who is very cunning. To avoid alarming Rome, Antiochus allowed Ptolemy the VI to continue ruling as a puppet king. Now again, he came in, well-meaning so-called, not to spook the Romans as to what he was truly up to. And he then became the protector, actually, of his nephew, Ptolemy the VI. A scholar wrote in the New Encyclopedia Britannica, Ptolemy the VI was Antiochus' nephew, Antiochus' sister Cleopatra I had married Ptolemy V, and Antiochus contented himself with ruling Egypt as Ptolemy's guardian, giving Rome no excuse for intervention. Verse 24, he shall enter into the quiet and plentiful province, and he shall do what that which his father hath not done, nor his father's fathers. He shall divide among them the prey and the spoil and the substance, yes, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. This expedition served to one degree as a fundraiser to pay the remainder of the war indemnity owed to Rome. That's why he would travel around, as we see in the various verses, and actually influence or plunder the areas. But this campaign had an additional positive dimension for Antiochus. The crusade and its success led to a shift of focus among his people from domestic problems to his brave actions in Egypt. Growing up, Antiochus observed that as long as his father was a successful conqueror, his people never failed to give the support to their king and master. And we see that even in modern history, as long as somebody wins quick and decisive victories, you know, you have the support of the people behind you. But as soon as you start to get muddled a little bit in a campaign or so, the folks will pretty quickly turn against you. But in order to live up to that expectation, Antiochus had to be infallible. Antiochus IV pursued a novel plan for gaining control of the Egyptian-controlled provinces. You know, and he's the smooth talker at the end of the day. And what he did is he moved into the parts of the kingdom that were the richest. Now, he went after the rich. I think one doesn't have to look too far where there's always this temptation, you know, go after a certain type people. Then he did something that no other Seleucid king had ever done, and politicians have taken note ever since. Antiochus IV spread around some of the spoils from his war campaigns to secure the loyalty of the people. A contemporary equivalent is when political candidates share some of the campaign spoils to do exactly the same, to secure themselves the loyalty of the people. This, I think we as a people of God have to be very much aware of smooth talking or folks who try to pull us over to a particular side, whether or not, again, it is from outside an organization within, whether or not it is from a politician that we want to get involved in. It seems like some individual sounds so right, you know, why don't we all support him? But before we know it, you know, he's obviously 180 degree the opposite of what we expected to be. Sometimes, you know, there are political appointments, promotions, and at times even ordinations that would fall under that to gain some kind of undue influence. Another parallel to modern politics is the issuing of steep spending bills, sometimes called stimulus bills, which all too often primarily used to reward the loyalty of institutions and of people. We see that too in how Washington does its politics. You know, those areas are usually awarded to whoever is mostly in line with whoever is in power. You know, that's why you have, you know, bridges to nowhere programs sometimes or stuff like that. The historical book of First Maccabees stated that he spent much on the public. It is even reported that he would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens there, again, to gain influence, where he knew sometimes certain individuals he couldn't just smooth talk into. You know, maybe just by giving him this, you know, and giving him a little bit that, a little handout, you know, will secure a particular, loyalty. Here is a quote from Bezalel Bar Kochba, states in Judas Maccabees, the Jewish struggle against the Seleucids. Quote, he and Antiochus scattered money amongst passers-by in the streets of Antioch and distributed unexpected gifts to people he didn't know. The gifts he sent to the Greek cities and temples were much costlier than those of his predecessors. The Daphne ceremony, which was partially financed by plunder from Egyptian temples, was another example of the wastefulness of Antiochus Epiphanes, shown by the vast quantities of spices, oil, opulent clothing, and gold and silver utensils displayed at the feasts and banquets. And again, this was only the beginning of Antiochus IV's plan. Verse 25, also he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great army and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast and practice against him. When Antiochus IV felt secure about the state of his own kingdom, he decided to take Egypt by force. He could only get so far by trying to be the protector and so forth, but then finally he wanted to have it all. What came to be known as the Sixth Syrian War. He regarded Ptolemy the Sixth as a weak ruler and therefore not capable of successfully waging war against him. Antiochus IV was able to move his army to the border of Egypt before he was met by the Egyptians at Pelusium, which is near the Nile Delta. The Egyptians had a large army arrayed against them, or against him there. Antiochus, risking death by riding into the midst of the battle of Pelusium, ordered the Egyptians to be taken alive. Sometimes he would do also something very brisk, you know, he would just kind of come in, and which can startle an enemy in itself, you know, by certain bravery or calculated risk that an individual can take. Verse 26, yes, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow, and many shall fall and be slain. Ptolemy's sixth army, although large, was not able to withstand Antiochus the Fourth. And then, you know, to a large extent, it was because of his superior army, but also because he had influenced and bought actually a lot of the government officials. And as such, then he was successful and installed someone loyal to him. Verse 27, and both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall take talk of deceit at one table, but it shall not avail, for yet the end shall be at a time appointed. Now, after he took control of Pelusium and Memphis, Antiochus IV set his sights on Alexandria. Due to intrigues of Antiochus IV mentioned in verse 26 that we saw, the Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to Ptolemy the Sixth and had made his younger brother Ptolemy the Seventh king in his place. And then it's incredibly, it just goes into tremendous, it's incredible how he was able to either by force through buying people's loyalty or just by flatteries or by rewarding people who are loyal to him, how he gained control. And again, it seems like it's the classic textbook as such. If one understands the life of Antiochus IV, it seems like that many politicians would take note of that. Being aligned and unified is absolutely essential. This is the next one, the next point I would like to briefly touch on. Being aligned and unified is absolutely essential. Verse 28, then shall he return to his land with great sustenance, for his heart shall be against the holy covenant, so shall he do, and return to his own land. Now here we see somebody to engage actually, with the people of God, you know, with his people. While Antiochus IV was engaged in Egypt, a false rumor arose in Judea that he had been killed. And on an earlier point, I kind of skipped over that, actually. There were various intrigues amongst the high priest, whoever was in line with in cahoots with Antiochus Epiphanes would then be installed to become the high priest. But before you know it, some other person would just bribe him and he would just swap around. And here is a deposed high priest, Jason, raised an army of 1,000 men to attack Jerusalem because they thought he was pretty safe now because Antiochus, after all, was dead. Antiochus, still in Egypt, was given notice that nonconformists in Judah were causing some disturbances. In line with his nature, Antiochus immediately rushed to the spot of trouble where he was welcomed by the Hellenistic Jews, those who had converted, obviously, to his viewpoints, to so-called the progressive ways. In the complete works of Josephus, Flavius Josephus states he and Tychus took the city without fighting, those of his own party opening the gates to him. And when he had gotten possession of Jerusalem and slew many of the opposite party, and when he had plundered it to a great deal of money, he returned to Antioch. His army captured the city, and he commanded his soldiers to kill everyone that they encountered, men, women, and children. Within the space of 3 days, his forces had killed between 40,000 and 80,000 people. A similar number was captured and sold into slavery. But again, the question here is, why was that necessary? It is because an individual, you know, the people of God were divided in essence. You know, those who were so-called more progressive, the Hellenists, and those who were faithful to God's way of life. And one side calling him for help. Just he coming in, sweeping in, and whoever was on the line with him, you know, they paid with their lives. And I guess it's a very important lesson for us, the people of God, wherever we are, in whatever organization we are, that we stand together, that we do not turn our backs on each other or play ourselves against each other. He took all the silver and gold as well as the hidden treasures which he found. Obviously, it was one of the, not only did a lot of people lose their lives, actually they lost everything in essence through an unnecessary battle by calling him in because the brother in essence turning on the brother. After appointing the Phrygian Philip as governor in Jerusalem, Antiochus IV then returned to Antioch. Verse 29, at the time appointed, he shall return and come toward the south, but the last shall not be as the first. Two individuals, there was a divided kingdom in Egypt by that time, or because of his scheming, and so by dividing the kingdom and by installing different kings in the Egyptian kingdom, those individuals said actually there are two brothers, nephews of his. You know, if we just get together, we could maybe hold our own against our uncle. But he, realizing that, he would then return, obviously, with a vengeance and turn against his nephews. And again, seeking war. However, this time he will not have the same success as he achieved previously. That's interesting, too. You know, one too many time he would mess with Egypt. But in this case, as we will see, the two nephews learn from their uncle and actually call on the Romans for help. The fourth point I would like to briefly touch on, knowing our Father and being faithful to him is paramount. Knowing our Father and being faithful to him is paramount. Verse 30, for the ships of Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be sorry and return and fret against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. There's a lot in this verse itself. Because they knew that they could not defeat Antiochus IV by themselves, the Ptolemy brothers appealed to Rome for help. In order to check the threat of Greek expansion, the Romans agreed to provide assistance. The ships of Kittim in this context is referred to the ships which brought the Roman legions to Egypt in fulfillment of the defense pact. Here's an interesting thing to say about his personality and also how he takes the brunt out against God's people. As Antiochus IV and his army marched over to Alexandria, they were met by three Roman senators led by Caius Popilius Laenas in a suburb of Alexandria. There the Roman ambassador Popilius delivered to Antiochus IV the Senate's demand that he withdraw from Egypt. Antiochus, he was quick to talk himself out of something or talk himself, you know, in a favorable position. But the Romans knew him. And he was a prisoner for a while, and he knew there were some. And as he is asking if he could just think about it, or maybe find another angle, it's actually also something that is never done before. the Roman ambassador Popilius actually takes a stick, draws a circle around Antiochus and say, you don't leave that circle in the presence of the military and all the leadership. You don't leave that circle till we have an answer. And of course, he quickly withdrew and he knew he could not withstand. But where is he heading next on the way back home to Syria? He's coming by Jerusalem. And again, he found individuals. They were still opposed to him because they're hanging on to their belief system. You know, he came, saw and conquered the opposing Orthodox Jews who held fast to their traditional beliefs. And this is where we have, you know, as we see a future fulfillment, it's very interesting to see. In the Jews, he found an easy prey, in essence. You know, he was just slighted by not only his two nephews who dared to call the Romans, but the Romans who make this ultimatum. And then he comes back and it just happens. People somehow squeal on each other or so. This, he does not do that, what you want him to do. Before you know it, he attacks without warning. And again, going after those elements that are not in conformance with him, that were not in conformance with the Hellenistic Syrian kingdom. It appears that these Jews became to Antiochus a synonym for trouble and opposition, which might explain why he came to see Judah as a whole and Jerusalem in particular as a spot on the map which deserved so-called special treatment. Because it's also what strikes for somebody who always tries to work with it or get some kind of an angle. When he came to the Jews, you know, in Judah around Jerusalem, he would just, in this case, he would just, his armies encircled Jerusalem and then attacked. And all those Jews who resisted were immediately executed. However, the pro-Hellenistic Jews, those he so-called could work with, allied themselves with Antiochus IV, were left unharmed. But how would he know those elements so quickly? Again, if he didn't have somebody who turns on somebody else. The implication is that he was showing regard to the elect who forsook the covenant of the Almighty. And this is where we go to the heart of this message. Even Jesus Christ said to watch the times. And as we see world events unfold around us, and as we see a lot of folks that seem to be very rational and well-meaning as they articulate their position or case, it might not always be so, you know, because it can backfire. Please turn with me to Matthew 24:42, but let's leave the place in Daniel 11 since we'll return there shortly. Matthew 24:42. Jesus admonishes us, the scripture we're well familiar with. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your master will come. For this be sure, that if the good man of the house knew at what watch the thief would come, he would surely watch and not suffer his house to be dug through. Having learned from the example of Antiochus Epiphanes, we can be alert for coming prophesied events. And as we know, one event will be moves to reintroduce daily sacrifices in Israel, and we'll go right into that after this. The second point, the rise of the man of lawlessness, a religious figure who claims to either be God manifest or God himself. In essence, that's what the meaning Antiochus Epiphanes is, God manifest. But the way he actually presented himself, that he is God himself. In essence, somebody coming onto the scene, not only claiming to be Jesus Christ, no, to actually claiming that he is the Father himself. Geopolitical events that will lead to armies massing around Israel and Jerusalem. The next point I would like to briefly touch on, they go hand in glove, obviously watching the time, is let's get our spiritual lives in order. In essence, that could be one and the same point. You know, watching the times, why would we be watching the times? The only purpose there is not to be aware of what's going on and see how right we were in our forecasts and or our interpretation of prophecy. No, it is to get our spiritual lives in order. There's the only purpose. Of course, as a warning message, but what is the warning message really? To get our spiritual lives in order. Matthew 24, verse 44, therefore be you also ready, for in the hour that you think not will the Son of Man come. The implication is to be ready for that time. Please return to Daniel 11. This is a clear admonishment for us to be ready. In order for us to be ready, we need to have our spiritual life in order. Verse 31, and arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall call away the daily sacrifice, and they shall set up the abominable desolation, so called the Baal Shamem. The army gave the beastly system power, and nothing is different today. Everything is still the same. The army gives this beastly system power. Or folks that are put in a position to spy on others, or some kind of a real or perceived form of authority over people. It's not just the army. That's how Nazism would succeed. No, are people spying on each other? That's how North Korea still exists, that regime, people turning, spying on each other. But ultimately, the beastly system, the army giving that beastly system power. An interesting observation is that armies tend to give beastly systems power, but our Father gives power to those who diligently seek Him, as evidenced on many occasions throughout the scriptures. Antiochus IV built a pagan altar over the altar of burnt offering in the temple and placed an image of Zeus, Olympus, upon it. 10 days later, and it's around the Christmas time frame, in December, swine flesh was offered on the altar to Zeus. Commenting on Daniel 11, verse 31, and speaking of the time when Antiochus marched into Jerusalem and the consequences it had for the Jews and on their worship, Elias Bickerman, in his work From Ezra to the Last of the Maccabees, notes, quote, at the end of the year 167 BC, approximately in December, by order of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, king of Syria and sole ruler of the Jews, the temple on Zion was desecrated and given over to the uses of idolatry. At the same time, the law of Moses was rescinded by a decree of the king. Observance of the commandments of the Torah, such as circumcision and the sanctification of Sabbath and new moon, was made a capital offense. In addition, the Jews were required to worship the gods of the Gentiles. The abomination of desolation hovered over the sanctuary and the wrath of God over the people. Never before and never thereafter was the spiritual existence of Israel so imperiled. What a depressing statement. Never before and never thereafter was the spiritual existence of Israel so imperiled. Just months after the current administration took office, the White House office of the press secretary on behalf of President Obama proclaimed June as Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month. And here is his decree. Now, if you think about that in this context, quote, now therefore I, Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim June 2009 as Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month. I call upon the people of the United States to turn back discrimination and prejudice everywhere it exists. Unquote. As we see, again, understand me correct, this has nothing to do against the current administration. I mean, even administrations before that, and many an administration, and not just in this nation, Western society all over the world. I mean, this could come from there. It just happens that it's just the way it's phrased in this context. Again, I don't mean that to be some kind of a witch hunt against our current sitting president, because we need to support the leadership within reason, as long as it's not against our Father's ordinances, obviously. But in this case, obviously, definitely against our Father's ordinances. As we observe modern Israel around us, how much lower can the spiritual existence you know, of our nation sink. We need to look at the statement and ask ourselves individually as well as collectively as the bride of Christ and also as this congregation right here today, what am I doing to get my spiritual life in order? Please turn with me to Revelation 22. But again, please keep your place in Daniel 11, since we will return there shortly. These admonishments are for each one of us, whether baptized or moving toward baptism. I cannot think of a more profound admonishment for us than outlined in Revelation 22, verses 10 and 11. Revelation 22, verse 10 to 11. To what degree are we engaged in getting our spiritual lives in order? And it is very much of a challenge, you know, seeing the influences of society around us, and everything is presented as the most natural thing in the world. It's easy to fall into that temptation to just take it, so-called take society or the spirit, the zeitgeist, the prevailing spirit, the spirit of the air, it just that to take that for, you know, this is just how things are. And before we know, it really causes tremendous damage on our spiritual life. Verse 10, and he, the Malach or the messenger said to me, do not seal the things of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. He who is unjust, let him be unjust still, and he who is filthy, let him be filthy still, and he who is righteous, let him be righteous still, and he who is holy, let him be holy still. Do we grasp the meaning of this passage? There will come a time in the end when our Father will seal us in the state that we are in. Who knows when that will take place for us personally or for mankind collectively. Now, before somebody is tempted to say, hey, let's have this little fun or have that little fun, we can always repent. We do not know that. No, we never know when we will be sealed or when our time has come. This passage contains a stark warning against doing our own things while forsaking the things of our Father. And again, let's not confuse. It's not things that a people or a group of people say should be done. It's truly the things of our Father. What is our relationship with our Father and Jesus Christ to his right hand? The final point I want to briefly touch on, let no one deceive us by any means. And I see those points all go hand in glove. And as let no one deceive us by any means. Please turn to me to the second epistle of Paul to the Thessalonians 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Hellenism incorporated the almost, if not exact, opposite of the Torah. And it's always interesting, too, that we see the attitudes of society around us, not just within this great state and great nation, in Western society or even beyond, just across the entire world. If you take the ways of our Father and you turn it upside down, this is pretty much where you have that zeitgeist, the attitude of this present age, right there. That's why it's not surprising. And it wasn't just Hellenism, I would say. Today's society, today's culture is almost, if not exact, the opposite of God's way of life. Upon outlining the entire value system of the Jews, Antiochus earned not only the title Epimanes, you know, among Orthodox Jews, they would call him the mad Epimanes, but also it came to be viewed as a type of Satan or anti-Messiah, or even to kick it up a notch, you know, the embodiment of being an anti-God, you know, in that sense, you know. But not only that, he was furthermore an anti-type of an anti-Christ to come. Jesus Christ inspired Paul to tell us that the major religious figure will arise at the time of the end. Even though we know that certain things will happen at the end of the age, we have to be fully aware at any given time people can arise to take us away, and sometimes for the least suspected source. That's why we have to be very circumspect and very aware. The admonishments we are about to discuss apply to each one of us baptized or moving toward baptism. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 to 4. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except there come a departing first, and that man of sin be disclosed, even the son of perdition. Paul was inspired to foretell that before the second coming of Jesus Christ, there shall be a throne set up, clean contrary to Christ's glory, in essence, wherein that wicked man shall sit and transfer all things that appertain to our Father to himself, and many shall fall away from the Father and Jesus Christ to him. We fully understand, and hopefully we understand, that Jesus Christ always pointed to the Father. Whoever that individual is who will come on the scene will behave like, not just like a Christ-like figure, but possibly even claim to be the Father himself. And as we know, many shall fall away from the Father and Jesus Christ. Verse 4, which is an adversary and exalts himself against all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he does sit as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Here we find an individual who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called our fathers or that is worshipped, so that he, as Jesus Christ, or even as the Father, sits in the temple, showing himself that he is the very Father himself. This wicked anti-Messiah represents the whole succession of the persecutors of the church of our Father and all that is abominable, as described by Daniel. He is called the teacher of sin because he sets himself up against our Father, his laws, and his church. However, this apostate leader will be destroyed by Christ at his second coming, as we see in verse 5 through 8, but not before he has deceived many with power, signs, and lying wonders, verses 9 through 12. This description fits prophecies of the second beast in Revelation 13, verse 11 through 14. Echoing Paul's warning, Revelation warns us that this leader, quote, performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth. His deceptive powers will be so great that most people will believe he is Epiphanes, not God manifest, or God himself. As we have seen, Antiochus Epiphanes tried to stamp out worship of our Father and ruthlessly persecuted all who remained obedient to the true God of Israel. But again, they were only stamped out if they weren't first sweet-talked into it, because there's no need to persecute somebody who was so-called willing to turn from the way of the true God. However, he has also made tremendous use of flatteries, as we have seen in Daniel 11, verse 32. And please turn with me to Daniel 11, verse 32. And such as wickedly break the covenant shall he cause to sin by flattery, but the people that do know their God shall prevail and prosper. But the people that do know their God shall prevail and prosper. After venting his anger upon the Jews and desecrating the temple, Antiochus IV decreed that his entire kingdom should become one people, each giving up his own customs. The other people under his rule accepted Antiochus IV's command. Because of his flattering approach, many of the people of Israel also forsook the law and adopted his religion. This is a word of caution to us today. Under what kind of circumstances would we break the relationship we have with our Father and Jesus Christ to his right hand? Antiochus IV commanded the change in all the ordinances of the Almighty. No sacrifices were to be offered in the sanctuary. The Sabbaths and feasts were to be profaned, and to choose for not to circumcise their sons. Upon pain of death, they were commanded to profane the true religion so that the law would be eventually forgotten. Because that's the opposite, that's the main reason why an individual like him would flatter people to start moving closer and closer, you know, away from the ways of our Father. Because ultimately what happens, and it doesn't take too long, you know, we have seen that in many of our friends who, in the mid-90s, who have decided to leave us spiritually. Many of those elements cannot even remember that there's such a thing as an festival or a feast of tabernacles and so forth, because it just gets forgotten. If we stop to practice, it will get forgotten. And Titus the Fourth appointed inspectors to watch the Jews and commanded the cities of Judah to offer pagan sacrifices. Yet many in Israel stood firm and rejected the innovations of the king of the north. And again, if you're not careful and we allow it to happen, that the body of Christ gets divided and divided through various elements, whoever those elements are, no, here we have a prime candidate in such an individual to become one of those inspectors. Many prophecies tell us that history will repeat itself, but this time on a much more massive scale. In the meantime, we are admonished to let no one deceive us, whether inside or outside of our fellowship. And again, it can come in many different forms, and I think I believe that we have not seen anything yet, as time and events will come to a climax. But do we give thanks to our Father for giving us the strength to stand firm and to reject the innovations of anyone, especially, you know, those who have left us spiritually throughout time? If we know our Father, then we have the assurance to be strong and to firmly resist anything and anyone attempting to separate us from the love of our Father and Jesus Christ to his right hand. Verse 33, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Verse 34 and 35, now when they shall fall, they shall be equipped with a little help, but many shall cleave unto them feignedly, hypocritically. And some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white till the time be out, for there is a time appointed. That day that remained constant among the people taught others by their example and taught many in the true faith. Whenever Antiochus IV men found copies of the Torah, they tore them to pieces and burnt them. Whoever was found in the possession of a Torah was put to death. According to Antiochus IV decree, women who had their children circumcised were put to death, along with their entire families and those who had circumcised them. Still, many in Israel chose to die rather than to break the holy covenant. And again, I don't mean that we are not circumspect and wise. You know, there's an element too where people seek out to be a martyr. And it's not what I'm talking about. It is really how do we stay close to our Father and stay true to his ways. You know, because ultimately we have the privilege to help others. But again, as we see, if you go quickly back to verse 33 here, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many. You know, even though there are difficult times ahead, it's not talking about a select few who teach others. No, it is really through conviction, through our example, as difficult as it is oftentimes in our daily lives, that our example shows what the true way is. And not to come across as preachy, but really, truly exhibiting the way of our Father, as difficult that it might be at times. In conclusion, the History Channel, I found this excerpt here. It's very interesting. In 1862, General Ulysses S. Grant lashes out at Jewish cotton speculators who he believed were the driving force behind the black market for cotton, and issues an order expelling all Jewish people from his military district, which encompassed parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Kentucky. At the time, Grant was trying to capture Vicksburg, Mississippi, the last major Confederate stronghold on the Mississippi River. Grant's army now effectively controlled much territory in western Tennessee, northern Mississippi, and parts of Kentucky and Arkansas. Grant had to deal with numerous speculators who followed his army in search of cotton. Cotton supplies were very short in the north, and these speculators could buy bales in the captured territories and sell it quickly for a good profit. In December 1862, Grant's father came to visit him along with friends from Ohio. Grant soon realized that the friends, who were Jewish, were speculators hoping to gain access to captured cotton. Grant was furious and fired off his notorious order number 11, quote, which states, "The Jews, as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from receipt of this order," unquote. The fallout from this action was swift. Among 30 Jewish families expelled from Paducah, Kentucky, was Caesar Caskell, who rallied support in Congress against the order. Shortly after the uproar, President Abraham Lincoln ordered Grant to rescind the order. As Julia Grant put it, the general had, quote, "no right to make an order against any special sect." That was his wife. Actually, I'm not sure how well, you know, this part of Civil War history is, but Union General Ulysses S. Grant decided to take out his deep-seated frustration with cotton speculators on the Jewish population in his military district. And it's very important to point that out. It's not against the speculator itself, because I'm sure there are others too, but he took it out on one group of people, Jews in this case. Not only did he just put an end to cotton speculation, but actually went away above and beyond to issue an order expelling all Jews, young or old, rich or poor, from his military district encompassing parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Kentucky. He seized the situation to engage in persecuting a particular people just because of who they were. According to history, Grant had to deal with numerous speculators who followed his army in search for cotton. Putting an end, again, to any form of speculation to take advantage of the situation would have been one thing. History would not have judged him for that. But instead, General Grant decided to fire off order number 11. You know, the Jews as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders are hereby expelled from the department within 24 hours from receipt of this order. And I don't think they saw it coming at all. You know, sometimes a certain sentiment can change pretty quickly. And to pack up everything, you know, old and young and old, and how quickly can you evacuate such a large territory within 24 hours? It was just unreasonable. How could a similar order in the future target people like us? I don't think too many cotton speculators are in this room, but just overall, as a group of people, you know, could all of a sudden there be a sentiment where something can come with even a very good president in this case, Abraham Lincoln? I think nobody would dispute that in this room. You know, he was one of the finer presidents, but he's one of his general here or key general, you know, ordering that. Not that we would be accused of that, but what could be, you know, tipping somebody off? Is it maybe because we are not willing to compromise with the ways of our father? The Jews were not only expelled, but were only given a very brief period to get out of there, a whopping 24 hours. According to the account, 30 Jewish families were expelled from Paducah, Kentucky, but fortunately for that individual, who appealed to Congress, you know, as soon as Congress heard and President Abraham Lincoln heard, you know, he was appalled and quickly ordered his general to rescind that order. But of course, that was more than 24 hours later. You know, they could obviously come back, but they had to get out of there and then could return. By singling out Jews, General Grant attempted to target the religious minority, let's face it. By doing so, he is and was by far not alone. Over the better part of 2 millennia, powers and authorities have moved to discourage, to dissuade, and to, if necessary, persuade people with different belief systems. Fortunately, in this great nation, you know, many of us have been spared of that because it was founded on religious freedom, but we have seen some of those freedoms erode. Could we become the target of the local, state, or national authorities because of our belief system? After all, shouldn't a God-fearing American embrace the religious festivals so deeply ingrained in Western culture? In this case, obviously, as we've seen, you know, with the just the coinciding with the timing in December, you know, offering of sacrifices, obviously, you know, the Christmas ham, not partaking in that, you know. Only our Father knows how much longer we can continue to gather in peace and quiet as the social mood could change with little or almost no advance notice, as we have seen in this. Shouldn't be surprised, like when Antiochus came back the second time, you know, when after he was humiliated by Ambassador Popilius, you know, he just pretty much attacked without warning. And those who were not part of his, in his line, you know, they, you couldn't think twice about it, you know, you just become the victim. What relevance does prophecy in general and the latter part of Daniel 11 in particular have for us today? We looked at just briefly looked at 7 facets. Our Father is in absolute control and world events happen according to His plan and purpose. 2, our all-consuming ambition to build or to tear down. 3, being aligned and unified is absolutely essential. 4, knowing our Father and being faithful to Him is paramount. 5, Jesus tells us to watch the times. 6, let's get our spiritual lives in order. And finally, 7, let no one deceive us by any means. Let's ask ourselves, how precious is our relationship with our Father? Do we really know our Father? How precious is His covenant to us? For if we know our Father, we will be strengthened and will be able to firmly resist. Amen.